I'd in that thinking as well. Anyway, go ahead. Interesting.
Well, there's actually, did you mention that there's a sort of a, I think that society, or very close to it, was a branch of what was the Society
British.
For Psychical Research that was founded in Britain.
Correct.
The man who was the secretary of the SPR in London for almost 20 years was a fellow by the name of Everard Fielding. Very close friend and follower of Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, if you read the book, you'll find out that the man who effectively was probably the fellow who recruited Crowley for British Naval Intelligence in 1914, who served throughout World War I for Naval Intelligence and MI6, and who was Crowley's basic case officer, was the same Everard Fielding.
No kidding. Wow. What a
same
cover.
Guy.
Interesting cover.
It connects back with something that I was mentioning just before the break about, you know, Crowley being connected to the OTO.
Mm-hmm.
And the OTO is a complex history there, but let's just say that the OTO has its origins as a German occult organization. And the man who recruited Crowley into that a couple of years before World War I, I think around 1912, was a fellow by the name of Theodore Royce. And guess what? Theodore Royce, if you begin to look into his background, along with being a sometimes singing waiter and journalist, was also a long-term German intelligence agent.
Mm.
And that was what I figured out was part of a key component in Crowley's credibility with Germans in New York. And it's one of the things, you know, we tend to think of Crowley as being an occultist, but the period of the First World War, early 20th, late 19th century, is not any different than today. Occult organizations, affiliations, interest in those things are widespread.
Oh, enormously so. And what is...
And,
go ahead.
Yes, and perhaps more so at the upper echelons of society, in government, within intelligence agencies. And so Crowley's not, his occultism is not weird. He moves in a world of which that's understandable, acceptable,
mm-hmm.
and that's what gives him credibility and influence. And throughout his time in New York, Crowley is in direct communication with Theodore Royce, who at the same time is working, building German intelligence networks in Switzerland.
Everybody was a spy back then. That was the era of human assets in intelligence. Now they use electronics and spies that are, they're hardly in the field anymore. They control assets, everything from satellites to ground relay networks, and you name it. It was different back then, and there were so many of them. And double and triple spies, and just amazing. What a time.
Well, a lot of them are fairly, you know, I ran into this in the research I was doing on Riley that I mentioned before. Riley was, in every respect, a thoroughly disreputable character.
Hmm.
And the British and others who employed him didn't do it because they liked him or trusted him. In fact, in many cases, they feared him and deeply mistrusted him. But the answer as to why we should employ him, and much the same applies to Crowley, there were many people who had great reservations about this guy. You find people in the Foreign Office and elsewhere who say that, you know, we don't want to touch him. But others certainly did. And the reason why people were willing to work with him, again, in some cases, in the case of Fielding, I think there was a friendship there. There was a common bond in the cult beliefs and membership. But in other cases, it's for the simple fact the reason you employ any kind of human asset is that you don't employ them because they're nice people. You employ them because they're useful. And again, Crowley's occultism, his connections and reputation were something that not everyone had. And he was someone who could gain access to circles and exercise influence there that other agents couldn't. And because of those unique characteristics, and, of course, the other thing is absolutely essential to this is a flexible personal morality. And he seems to have had that as well.
A flexible personal morality. I like that. Yes.
That
contextual morality, as it were.
Yeah. I mean, he could justify doing these things.
Sure. All right. Well, touch on a couple of the other highlights, if mm-hmm. you would, Richard, in our remaining minutes. We've got about 7 minutes left, and I want to kind of tease people as much as we can about this fascinating book you put together.
Well, there's all. Crowley spends a few other episodes in this. Some people who know about Crowley's history may note that after World War One, he goes off and sort of starts his own kind of early version of a hippie commune in Sicily.
Right.
Tries to found his own sort of religious school there. Doesn't work out too well for any number of reasons. His growing heroin addiction was one of those problems. But the other thing that I discovered is that there's an intelligence dimension to that as well. When Mussolini's police in 1923 eventually boot him out of the country, one of the things they subsequently discover at the Abbey are documents traceable to British intelligence that had been delivered to Crowley there, and also reports that he or someone else had written and which he was forwarding through the British consulate in Palermo about conditions in Italy, reports critical of the fascist regime. He also manages to get himself booted out of France in 1929, and again, the basic underlying reasons are that the French suspected him of spying not so much for the British this time, but for the Germans. And in the wake of that, he's sort of brought back into the British fold, actually has a personal interview with one of the chief officers of Scotland Yard, its liaison to other elements of British intelligence, a man by the name of Colonel Carter. And Colonel Carter turns around and sends him into Berlin, sends him into Germany to keep an eye on IRA agents and also what's happening with the communists and the Nazis there.
Mm-hmm.
Crowley's on the scene in Germany in that period when the Weimar Republic is collapsing and the Nazis rise to power.
He must have been
kind of eyewitness.
Yeah, he must have been higher than a kite to be around that kind of incredible energy and shift in power. That was a pivotal moment in modern history. Wow, he was right in there, huh? Amazing.
Yeah, the Nazis. He also makes overtures to Stalin as well. In the view of MI5, which is sort of the British FBI during the 30s, they actually had him pegged throughout this period as a lefty.
Mm.
Because one of their files, at one point they had three on him, all of supposedly destroyed, but on one of their files has the prefix PP, and PP stands for peace propaganda, but what it really means is Pinko, or someone we suspect was a communist or communist sympathizer.
Got it.
And therefore he's in there. And in fact, one of the people he had contact with in this period was a fellow by the name of Louis Gibarty, who is one of the chief representatives of the Communist International in Western Europe. So he was sort of keeping an eye on... Crowley is a chameleon. He's a man who played many roles, I guess, as sort of befits him. And one of the questions you always have to end up asking and looking at sideways and upside down is, where's the real Crowley?
Where is the real Crowley? Indeed. We have three minutes left, and I can't let you get away without asking about the peace flight of Rudolf Hess to England.
Rudolf Hess. It's one of those things. This is where, now there's several people who figure in this. One of the names that most people recognize is Ian Fleming. And of course, Ian Fleming was working at the time, this is early World War II, for British Naval Intelligence. In fact, when the war breaks out in 1939, Fleming's boss, Admiral Godfrey, the new head of British Intelligence, invites Crowley to come down for an interview, brings him in, and wants to talk to him. Actually gives him a number to call. And one of the things I was able to do was this number in Naval Intelligence and what it was connected to, and it links to a branch which was connected to the interrogation of prisoners of war. Okay, now keep in mind, this is long before Hess gets there. This is in 39. Ian Fleming himself later admitted that one of the things that he and his boss wanted to do, but they never could quite work out, was to have Crowley interrogate Rudolf Hess. And in fact, Crowley wrote a letter in which he offers to do that, because I have particular talents I can think to bring to it. There is a rumor, a story which supposedly, and it's no more than that, it's not one of the things that can be confirmed, all those other things, the involvement of Fleming, Crowley's offer, his letter of invitation to discuss this with the Chief of Naval Intelligence, those are all documentable, but the one fascinating aspect of this is the possibility that he actually did get to meet Rudolf Hess at a kind of secret Guantanamo-like prison that MI5 ran for prisoners of war called Camp 020.
Huh.
There's a former German POW there who insists that when he was there, he saw Hess there and he saw Crowley there. Now, this could all be somebody's fantasy.
Uh-huh.
But it may not be, because my suspicion, and you'd have to read the book to figure out, is that there were other people interested in interviewing Hess, and one of the